This is the American Fashion Podcast, the fashion industry's favorite show, our weekly look under the hood of the fashion business. Don't miss the show notes for links to books, videos, and brands mentioned in each episode, as well as a link to AmericanFashionPodcast.com, where you can find more information about the series, hosts, and how to be a guest. You'll also find a link to an archive of hundreds of episodes going back to 2014, which include interviews with top designers, insights for beginners on building a brand, sustainability tips, deep thoughts, and all kinds of amazing detail about how this industry functions in all the little niches from a broad range of leaders and experts.
This is American Fashion Podcast. I'm Charles Beckwith here with Kathy Sheppes.
Hi, everyone.
And our guests in the studio, there are four of them. We have Libby Mattern from Course of Trade. She's the founder of Course of Trade. Hi, Libby.
Hello.
Libby, you've been on the show before with Malia Mills. Can you give us a short review of what Course of Trade does?
Sure. So Course of Trade is an industrial sewing training program. We're in Brooklyn, New York. We're in Sunset Park. And we pay students to go through 120 hours of industrial sewing training. And then we place them at jobs in the garment district.
Wonderful. And Sarah Crassley is the CEO of Shimmy Technologies. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Sarah, tell me a little bit about Shimmy Technologies.
Well, we are a B2B SaaS company. We're also based in Brooklyn, but in the Navy Yard. And our focus is preparing the apparel sector for the future of work. So we really look at how is the industry automating and how do we make sure that the workforce is prepared and ready to assume those roles.
Okay. And we also have Lee Wellington, who's the executive director of the Urban Manufacturing Alliance. Hi, Lee.
Hello.
Tell me a little bit about the Urban Manufacturing Alliance.
Sure. So the Urban Manufacturing Alliance is an organization that lifts up making and manufacturing in cities all across the nation. And our members are actually much like the other guests on your show, right? They're the organizations that are helping to make sure that not only businesses can thrive in cities, but also that people and communities can connect to those businesses and have on-ramps to those businesses. And a growing segment of our membership are actually sewn trades organizations, so those that are actually training around industrial sewing or thinking about how you connect garment and textile businesses to one another. So pleased to be here today.
Interesting. And Lisa Futterman is the regional director for New York City for the Workforce Development Institute. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
And as our listeners may be suspecting, this is an episode about workforce development. So, Lisa, tell us a little bit about the Workforce Development Institute and workforce development in general, if you don't mind.
Sure. So the Workforce Development Institute is a nonprofit organization headquartered out of Albany and Troy, but we cover 10 regions of New York State. So I cover the New York City region. Our broad mission is to help New Yorkers obtain and keep good jobs. So we do that in a number of ways. We're a convener for great conversations that help both industry and job seekers. We connect entities to one another for sources of technical assistance and funding. We provide grants in some cases to both manufacturers and nonprofit organizations that train job seekers, as well as supporting unions. So in my role as the New York City Regional Director, the piece of my work that focuses on supporting manufacturing, I kind of naturally focused on the apparel manufacturing sector because there were many, many needs facing those companies. But really, we help manufacturers across the board and get involved in lots of different workforce initiatives. Your question about what is workforce development?
For the fashion business, what is workforce development?
Sure. Well, I think it applies to generally as well as for the fashion business. Really, workforce development is looking at both the skill needs of employers to be able to remain competitive and, you know, produce, in the case of manufacturing, produce their products efficiently. And it's also the need for skill development for job seekers and training programs that address those needs and allows people to earn a living wage and have a good quality job. So it's really both those things. In the apparel manufacturing sector, there are lots of challenges around that. A lot of that related to the historical offshoring of the industry, and then some subsequent growth and some reshoring, but really different challenges and needs. There's a major real estate crisis here in New York City, and so I think a lot of apparel manufacturers are in what I would call survival mode. They're not really able to focus as much on training their incumbent workforce as they probably would like to. They're wearing so many hats. They're juggling so many things. They're dealing with rising rents. Many of them have to move multiple times because their lease ends and they try to find a new lease. So there are just many, many pain points for apparel manufacturers in particular. And so that's an area where I've tried to focus on providing some assistance to those companies.
Now, is it normal for a state to provide this? Is this something that's in all the 50 states?
No, it's actually really unusual. And when I meet with people in other states, they're especially manufacturers, they're kind of jealous that, you know, WDI exists in New York State. So the way our funding works is that we're funded by the state Senate. And so senators put our budget request into the state budget every year. And hopefully, nine times out of ten, we don't get cut at all, and the governor okays our budget. And so that's how that works. But we are an independent nonprofit, but we do rely on the state legislature, who see a need for the work that we do, and so have continued to push for that support for us. We're grateful for that.
So if any of our listeners are from other states, would it be possible for another state to also fund your organization and get your resources into their states?
I mean, we are very much New York State focused, but certainly we do get involved nationally in some initiatives. So we look at like workforce strategies, and some of our staff do attend conferences in other states and kind of share our lessons learned here in New York State. So we're very happy to share expertise. And, you know, Lee's organization, the Urban Manufacturing Alliance, I was at their conference in Pittsburgh a year and a half ago. And so, we do kind of collaborate with folks in other states that are doing related work and try and share best practice.
Now, this may be a pretty obvious question, but why does the fashion business need workforce development? Why do people need to be trained for new jobs in the fashion business?
Well,
and that's for anybody.
Sure. Why don't someone else can weigh in, and I can jump in after that.
Well, I think when we talk about made in U.S. initiatives in this country, trade union professionals, manufacturers all talk about the bottleneck being just a labor shortage in general. And I think, very simply put, that's because a lot of people don't want to work in garment factories. They have the vision of that as like Norma Rae standing on top of the spinning machine, and it's not that anymore. So I think that's one problem. And I think the second problem is that there's new equipment coming into factories, and that requires people to have different skill sets than they might have had being a traditional sewing machine operator or cutter on a factory floor.
The other thing I would add is much of the sustained job losses that were faced by the manufacturing sector came from apparel and textile. And so there are families that over generations watched opportunities get washed out. So that's, I think, fueling in part the perception gap that there aren't opportunities associated with the sewn trades. And then additionally, when you have job losses of those of that magnitude, you have a workforce apparatus that gets dismantled. And so we have a lot of rebuilding to do as a city. And really, this is true of cities nationally, to reinvigorate not only the hearts and minds of people thinking about opportunities in the sewn trades, but also the underlying workforce infrastructure that supports those firms.
And I think also what we're seeing right now is a resurgence of small lot production, which is really where New York City thrives. We have a ton of small factories that can get quick production into the market. And what we're faced with right now is a generational gap. We have sewers who are aging out of the workforce and nobody's coming up behind them. So if we're going to continue to be able to keep up with the demand of small lot production, we do need to be looking forward at the people who are going to be retiring and replacing them in the workforce.
And if somebody goes into this as their job, if they get the training, is it going to be a good paying job for a long time? Because I think that would be a question most people would have. I'm going to be trained to be a professional sewer. Is that a career?
Absolutely. It's a great job. And the sewers, at Malia Mills, I work within the Malia Mills office in Sunset Park. So we are kind of a for-profit, nonprofit partnership. And our sewers have been with us for 15 years, and they're amazing, and they get paid well, and they get benefits. And I think that's increasingly becoming the norm.
I feel as if there needs to be new value or renewed value put on sewing, pattern making, and just the trade in general. What made you identify this need and start to train? And how did you even start the training? What can I call it, a school? Or
sure, we can call it a school. It kind of all came about when we moved out to Sunset Park. And you know, I had been working in a garment production factory before this in Bridal, and then moved over to handling Malia's production. And I really wanted to open my own factory, and I couldn't find people to sew. And I was trying to navigate this very complex way of, you know, word of mouth, trying to find through our sewers another sewer who might know someone, who might know somebody else who needed a job for a week. You know, it's this really, really cumbersome process. And what I realized was the people who we were hiring were, you know, in their 60s, and they wanted work for 2 days a week, and that's not really what we needed. We needed a full-time sewer, and we needed multiple full-time sewers. So I came up with this program. It's built in modules, and it's in 3 languages currently. So I can train in Spanish, Mandarin, and English, in part because of the Malia Mills team. We have Cantonese, Mandarin, and Spanish speakers on staff, so they really help me a ton. And it's been incredibly gratifying to see how people take to sewing and the confidence that comes with it, and how factories where we place students are responding to it. I think people are really excited to get new people in and help them and foster their development.
And I just like to add that, so WDI-funded course of trade, you know, because we saw that, I mean, I've been visiting garment factories for the last 4 years, and I'm consistently hearing about a need for skilled sewers. In my kind of investigations into this, really students aren't learning those industrial skills anymore. And even at the CTE high schools, the career and technical education high schools, students are learning some of those skills, but they're really, they're all choosing to go into a career as a fashion designer for the most part. So there hasn't been that emphasis on those industrial skills as much as there was in the past. So there's been a real lack of training programs. I spent a couple of years trying to look into what are the training programs? How could we put something together? Is there a factory that would loan their space in the evening? Or could we do it at the high school? FIT's labs are so oversubscribed, it's very difficult to schedule training programs there for adult learners. So, you know, got introduced to Libby and heard about the training that, you know, she had developed, and we were really excited to put some funding toward that so that she could train more people and fill more of those open roles.
Lisa helped us get 16 new machines, which is amazing.
Right, because you can want to train, but then it's like, what techniques or what innovative, techniques are you using? And actually, Sarah, maybe just talk about what you had discovered in terms of learning.
Yeah, so we've started our work in Asia and really the thing that we're focused on is how do you take folks who are working on the factory floor and leapfrog them into doing the highly valuable work that's needed in the industry later. So in Asia, automation is already coming into high-yield factories, and it's not like big, hulking systems like you'd find in a car factory. It's just quiet little features that are being introduced in new sewing machines, and then poof, you have a layoff of about 30 workers in a department. So we've used gaming as a way to get workers who have never even used any technology whatsoever in a system, feeling confident and moving into learning things like digital pattern making, laying out markers, and putting pieces together to form the basis of 3D assembly, because we know that they're going to need to be more workers who can make digital designs, who can look at them and use them to tell a robot what to do, and to also power these customization labs that we know are coming down the pike eventually.
So this is, I mean, it's incredible because, I mean, there are times where we're thinking that people just can't get over the block.
Yeah.
Right? Of being able to learn.
Yeah.
And gaming is like genius.
Yeah. And similar to Libby's approach, our software is multilingual. So we've taught an AI a power-related vocabulary in multiple languages. And we've built that architecture so we can quickly scale and go to multiple languages.
And I'll just add, you know, from the Urban Manufacturing Alliance vantage point, there are organizations with varying degrees of capacity as they train industrial sewers. Some that are entirely craft focused, some that are more focused on preparing the next generation of sewers for the tech adoption that's coming. And so we sit in a really beautiful and unique spot where we can connect the dots between somebody like Sarah and Shimming Technologies that has developed this technology, and then a sewn trades organization that's just getting started and building their curriculum. And so we can do that sort of matchmaking that's so critical as these groups are getting off the ground in their communities, often with little sort of support or institutional buy-in behind them, at least at the very beginning. So we're in this place where we can start to make the matches.
That's interesting. When you talk about technology and new technologies coming up, how technical are sewers going to have to be?
Mm. Well, I think we should look at, you know, automation in the U.S. market, right? As Libby pointed out, there's definitely a demand for quick turn and small batch production. But we also need to think about larger batch stuff that doesn't have a lot of changes in design. So things that aren't exciting, but curtain, no offense to anyone listening who's a curtain designer, but, you know, curtains or mattresses or sheets, workwear, uniforms, things that don't change their design very often are great candidates for automated production. So I think we'll see investments in factories that are producing those things. And the automation would come later, I think, for smaller batch, just because you don't get the payoff for all the programming you need to set up in order to facilitate that.
This is like an assembly line for manufacturing, like a hard good, mm-hmm. where you'd have the machinery drilled
and
it's got the tooling, the exact
that.
Shape of the product. And then if you change the product slightly, you have to throw all of that out and restart. And it's thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to do that. And it's very similar in the fashion business if you're automating things. Now, we've got these nimble automation systems that are coming, but the sew box break down pretty often, and you got to have people there to keep an eye on them, even when they're making a T-shirt. So when you start to step up to something that's never been spit out of a machine before, where you designed on the computer and then it's just going to print, that's going to take a while. The automation won't be there for a while.
I think if we keep thinking about it as sew bots, yes, but
yeah.
We need to also think about the distributed automation that's coming by, you know, automating a belt loop or something like that. You know, that's a workforce.
So partial automation is something that you think is possible. Because not seeing that small lots can actually go to complete automation, and yet for a large part of the industry and sustainability, small lotability is what we need.
And I would say that's what we're seeing in other areas of manufacturing. So as particularly in New York City, where there, you know, we can't really have huge factories here. We don't really have the space. So the size of New York City manufacturing companies is smaller than in other parts of the state and other parts of the country. But Steinway pianos are made in New York City. And, they have a robotic arm that they just invested in the last couple of years. It's the first big piece of automation that they put into their process, because really those pianos are made by hand. But it can take away some of the redundant, repetitive tasks that can really, cause injury to workers and health issues, and, has been a great solution for them, whereas many aspects have to be handmade. In the apparel industry, I think, in New York City shines in creating really high-end, complex garments, which even some big-name designers still make in New York City, because we have that skill level and that level of expertise here.
The other thing I would add is the way we characterize advanced manufacturing across subsectors. I think most of the time when you imagine advanced manufacturing, garment and textile doesn't come to mind. Food doesn't come to mind. Pianos don't pop into one's mind. But really sort of embracing the fact that fashion is going to become part of this high-tech ecosystem is going to be critical as we design policy to support manufacturing broadly. I think economic developers often are attracted to, well, how do I bring advanced manufacturing into a city? And they completely overlook initiatives around apparel and textile. And so I think the hope is that that can change. The other sort of separate point that I'd add is, I think if people felt that automation was going to wipe out these jobs in apparel and textile, none of us would be sitting here doing what we were doing. I think the way I personally see it is that we may have fewer jobs in apparel and textile for an individual business, but we're going to have more innovation, and we're going to have higher quality jobs with career ladders, and we're going to have an opportunity to rapidly iterate and get things to market quickly. And that's going to lead to actually a net positive number of jobs, even though the factories are going to get smaller and some of the jobs that require lesser skill or lower degree of skills are going to be replaced by some form of technology. At least that's my perspective on it.
So generally with the automation coming in on the repetitive tasks, that means sewing is going to be a more interesting job.
Precisely.
Here's hoping, yeah.
Right. Right. With career ladders, right? And a way to move up.
Mm-hmm. And we're excited. So Lisa invited Shimi to join the CTE panel that she was talking about earlier. And I went to the Brooklyn Steam Center, which was a $14 million project in the Navy Yard. And I went to the room that was looking at construction manufacturing, in, you know, setting up stages for films. And what do I see but industrial sewing machines included in their STEM and STEAM curriculum? So I think even educating folks that, that, you know, technical design is as difficult as mechanical engineering, and it should be part of that curriculum, I think will bring a lot of new folks into our industry.
Can you define STEM and STEAM before we move on?
Sure. So it depends on who you talk to. So STEAM includes art in science, technology, engineering,
math.
Art, and then mathematics.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe Lee should do it.
What was I going to say? Sorry.
Was it about the?
I believe there is a skill shortage in, like backstage roles, including repair of costumes, costume production. So that's a whole other area where, you know, people may not realize that there could be really interesting, exciting roles that involve
sewing. I think Sarah mentioned it, but more technical, you know, there's technical design skills that are incredible skills and are absolutely needed. And what I was going to ask you is, from the apparel industry, what other requests are you getting for skills outside of sewing?
Well, so every factory you visit is using different equipment. So many of them will have specific pieces of equipment where they've got one person that knows how to operate it. So I'm not a technical expert on the different pieces of equipment that I see in apparel factories, but, you know, each factory will tell you they have totally different needs from another factory. I just visited a factory that needs advanced buttonhole equipment and training for workers on, you know, how to use that. So it really depends factory to factory.
Because I do see the few small factories that I've been in lately, the managerial piece is needed also, I think. And also the coaching piece on if something's wrong, is it only the owner who's working with the sewer or the pattern maker in terms of what the issues are?
I think there are a lot of challenges facing, particularly in New York City, some of the factories. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of them are in survival mode. So they're just not able to take the time to train their workforce, train them in sometimes English language, invest in English language skills training, managerial training, supervisory training. But I think there's a lot of opportunity, and there's some companies that are doing that great, that really are addressing those things. But there are many that are just battling the real estate crisis here. And so help that they get from entities, you know, that can provide some funding support or access to training opportunities are really needed by the industry. One skill need I do hear about fairly often is apparently there are only one or two people that know how to fix all the industrial machines.
Yes, I hear that over and over again.
So I think that's a good apprenticeship, perhaps a future apprenticeship program.
Call City Sewing.
Robin is the best.
Yeah, I remember talking with a soft goods manufacturer in Baltimore who said that if their sewing machine repair person ever went out, they'd be done. And they really identified that as a gap in their ecosystem. So I think that this is true in New York. It's true in cities across the nation.
American Fashion Podcast is a bit like a community radio station for the fashion industry. That's what it was intended to be from the start. We do it for you, and we want you involved in the conversation. We all need the fashion industry community to continue the conversation. When we do our interviews each week, this is a beginning. And if it's to do any good, now it has to spread. If you like something someone says here, if some concept resonates with you, let your community and colleagues know. Reach out and share. This is a community thing. We are at AF Pod on Twitter, and on Instagram, we're at American Fashion Show. If you really like an episode, please take a screenshot and tag us so other people can learn about the things we talk about. Not enough people are exposed to these important conversations. We need your help to spread the word. Tell someone or a lot of people about this show, about what we discuss on this show, about ethical practices in our industry. Put a note about something real that we talk about in your newsletter, on your blog, on Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. If you're a writer, please write reactions to these conversations. And if there is an issue that just burns you up, if we are looking at an issue wrong, please give us a shout. Let's have that discussion. 646-979-8709 is our voicemail line, and info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com is our email address. After this episode ends, we've done what we can, and it's on you to continue the conversation.
A lot of the computer systems have been automated, where you thought a lot of people would be going into information technology and this would be a big career, but a lot of people are stuck in relatively low-paying jobs in those fields, and people are still going to school for these things, even though a lot of their functions have been automated. I mean, you've got the cloud, that's this big network, and that means all these little networks don't need as much maintenance because they're smaller. And I wonder if a lot of those technical people who are going toward running networks might be better served by going toward more of the hardware stuff and being able to fix little machine parts and things, because it seems like that's a skill that not enough people have lately.
Yeah, I think that physical production is sort of stigmatized within our educational system. It's sort of like if you can't perform academically, then where do you end up? You end up in production. But if we instead infuse our educational system with a new pedagogical approach where the work of working with one's hands are actually celebrated, it seems like we would be in a much better position to one, get people excited about manufacturing without telling them that they have to go on one pathway or another. And two, whether or not they end up in production, I think it just shapes the way that we learn in a different way. And so it's worth investing in whether or not there's a linear path to manufacturing or not.
I think most people don't even know what it means.
Right.
You know, there's no exposure to the different elements that go into manufacturing. You know, you can go into manufacturing and you can be a sewer, you can be a cutter. There's a million different jobs at a fashion house. There's distribution, there's quality control. It's an intense workforce that people just, I don't think there's a ton of education on the different tracks that you can go down.
And not only that, I just think in terms of tech adoption, we've been focused a lot on how the factory floors are evolving, but also what is being produced is shifting radically. So as you think about the types of fabrics that are being used as inputs, as you're thinking about things like wearable tech, medical devices that have apparel component to it, all of these pieces are sort of shifting the opportunities in the sector. So it's more than just the way legacy businesses are running their shops. It's also all of the new innovation that the sector is experiencing.
And I think, too, it's like I've always been very skeptical about sustainability being something that actually drives purchasing behavior at scale. But I really think that there is some power lately behind the stories of the makers and the people that make things. You know, the reason I buy Malia Mills bathing suits are because they fit really well, but also there's an amazing group of women who make them, and the brand is exciting. And I think UMA is doing fantastic work in telling people these are the makers that are making things all over this country, and this is what the environments where they work in look like.
So one thing I'd just like to go back a little bit to how we're young people are learning about manufacturing roles. So I am involved with the Department of Education here in New York City with their Career and Technical Education High School Commission, which Sarah mentioned earlier. And so the Department of Education is trying to focus. It's a big system. But they are trying to focus on connecting young people to industry. And so part of my role in a volunteer capacity in helping that group has been we've put together two fashion career days over the past 2 years. And that generally happens in February, so we'll probably be doing another one, where we've put together a panel of experts from the fashion industry and then brought students the 10 or 15 block walk to factories in the garment district, so that they can, you know, firsthand see things being made. The young people were so excited to be in factories and, you know, see some of the equipment being used and some of the designs that were seen on, you know, red carpets and other places. And it really makes it real. And so there are some good programs happening, connecting. There are three high schools in the city that have fashion studies. And so making sure to connect those young people to actually see production in action.
I'm kind of reminded of there's a John Lovitz movie. I think it's called High School High, where he's a high school teacher. It's very farcical. And in teaching the students, he teaches them how to open a book physically.
Right. Right.
And it's like, this is what a factory looks like.
Right.
And they've never been to one.
Right.
Because that's not who we are right. as a country anymore.
Yeah. And then another really great thing is that the Department of Education actually offers externships to teachers during the summer or other holidays. And so a teacher spent time in one of the garment center factories, Thompson's International Pleating, and learned, you know, from masters of pleating, you know, how to do it. And it's a very scientific process. It's really it's really mathematical, figuring out pleating and yardage and all of that. And so that teacher is now bringing that knowledge back to her classroom and doing that work with her students.
And we had a teacher this summer do an externship like that with us, and she came with us for a week. She learned the basics of CAD and 3D, and she taught us this is how you teach students to achieve a certain accreditation exam. So we both got equal amounts out of it. It was a wonderful program.
That's great. So the opportunities like that can really make a big difference.
And it is about people starting to learn again what the industry, what it really means. So that means marketing. And that means dollars. So how are you marketing your causes? I don't want to call them causes, but, you know, how is the word getting out in terms of what each of your organizations can do? How do you garner support?
And there's so much silence because I think...
I know, sorry.
Like, oh my God. There's not an, there's certainly, question. There aren't enough champions to help get this work out and really lift this up. Sometimes it feels a bit niche at a time when it also feels so urgent. I'll just say one of the things that we noticed, which is really encouraging in research that we were doing, not just on garment and textile, but manufacturing across the board. We were in 6 different cities trying to collect data on very small scale manufacturers. And in almost every one of the cities we were in, there was a early stage sewn trades organization that had been launched. And that was not something that we set out to find, right? Like we weren't focused on a specific subsector. We weren't trying to create a group around the sewn trades, but we came out of this study, this giant data collection effort, knowing that we had to create a home, a collaborative platform for these sewn trades groups to connect with one another. The next step, I think, is for some much broader ecosystem mapping. So not necessarily the place-based work that's happening at each individual city, but sort of the systems-wide work that's happening. So this university is doing this innovative program. Shimmy is doing this. This state has legislation in place to fund a workforce program that's then going to build capacity for the sewn trades. How do we replicate that? This organization has built out an apprenticeship curriculum that can be scaled. And so how do we take all of those resources, map them, and then allow these early stage groups to draw from something that's bigger than themselves? I'd love to see resources behind that. And that's something that UMA is really committed to working on. So that matchmaking between, say, a Shimmy and a sewn trades group is not only by somebody like me connecting the dots, but there's actually a piece of paper that tells you that story.
I would say that at WDI, we really rely a lot on referrals. So a lot of it's networking, getting to know folks in the community. We want to work with companies that are treating their employees well, that have a good work culture, that, you know, workers are safe and hopefully receiving benefits, or at least that's an option for them. So we do try and focus in on good quality companies. We do want our focus is on the workforce, so we do want to work with companies that generally, I would say, have at least 4 production workers or more. It's difficult for us to impact the workforce if the company is really tiny. So generally, we might give other kinds of support to a company that's smaller than that, but keep in touch with them as they grow. And, you know, if they have an opportunity to scale up their workforce, we can kind of step in and help out with that.
I should also just add the Council of Fashion Designers of America has been a really important partner in lifting up this work to many of the large brands that are represented in their network, as well as smaller brands. And, you know, they have a partnership with the New York City Economic Development Corporation to help with everything from localizing production to technology adoption to workforce training as well. And so they're another sort of voice for this movement.
Absolutely. And we partner with them as well.
And CFDA has resources also on their site for
people.
Yeah,
much better than they used to have.
Right.
Their website has a lot of resources that weren't there before. Is it CFDA.com, I think?
And they have some new exciting programming as well, which I won't get into too much, but they have a new initiative to give incentives for companies that are looking to reshore some of their production.
That's exactly what I was just going to ask about, was how can you garner support from on the brand side? Because obviously it's in their interest, so.
Yeah, so CFDA has been working to help the local manufacturers, and so that's an added new program that they announced about a month or so ago. So I would just read more on their website. I'm not able to give the specifics about it, but they have been thinking through how they can provide incentives for companies that are interested in bringing some of their production back.
Mm-hmm. And at an intergovernmental level, you know, I serve on the World Economic Forum's Task Force for Reskilling. And at that level, you're talking to digital literacy initiatives inside countries. You know, our point is that as those factory floor jobs diminish, we'll need to reallocate workers into adjacent industries. So we're really excited to think about if somebody's really good at laying out a seam, could that skill be applicable to them working in a semiconductor factory or laying out circuitry? So that group has been really exciting to think about connection points there as well.
I think it is about, you know, putting the glory back and helping individuals to recognize how interesting the field can be. Even as you say, you know, one thing you learn in apparel, you can then apply to other industries.
Yeah, and I think we have to think about another workforce that's going to come in and help us make clothes. It's more machines and it's more artificial intelligence. Whether we want to admit that or whether we like it, it's going to be part of our making process. So let's figure out a way where we get human beings to shine and what they're good at, and we leave the redundant, boring work that nobody likes to do anyway to computers and machines.
I'm wondering, am I allowed to ask a question?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So I'm just wondering, from all of your perspectives, what you see are ways to lower barriers for entrepreneurs entering this sector. You know, Lisa talked about the survival mode that so many manufacturers are in here in New York City, in large part because real estate is so costly. But entrepreneurs entering the manufacturing sector have, you know, a very challenging time just dealing with the startup costs alone. How do you sort of equip them with the right training infrastructure as well when they're only hiring like one, maybe two people as they get going? And I'm curious, Libby, like if you're if the people that you're working with are kind of in that position.
In terms of the factories?
Companies, yeah.
Yeah. So the factories that we've been working with, some of them are relatively small. And it's the challenge for them is timing. You know, and that's one of the issues that's widespread over all of the fashion industry is this, you know, the ebb and flow of work. So I think there is something to be said for trying to figure out a way that we can help sort of create a level workforce over the course of a year in terms of the work that factories are getting, because what they're finding and what is always a pain point for factories is they hire people and then they have to let them go. And that's a challenge for me too when I'm placing people, because I want to ensure that I'm placing someone in a role that they can thrive, you know, they can be there for a while. And that is, I'm not entirely sure what the solve is. And I have some ideas, but we have to come up with some sort of coalition to sort of help level that workforce out. And that to me is one of the biggest challenges with the small, smaller factories.
Well, and that's capacity. And mm-hmm. maybe that is also with some of the smaller factories and maybe a large one, you know, being able to get them to partner together
exactly.
to help one another. Because, mm-hmm. yeah.
The fact that there are probably 900 niche manufacturers still in the Garment Center, some of which have gone to Long Island City mm-hmm. and other places at this point. But the fact that they're all separate companies makes no sense because you have all of this overhead for accounting and HR and all these things where, you know, 10 of them could get together and save, what, 25% of their operating costs mm-hmm. just from having the same structure. But they're all these weird little companies with weird little people running them, which we
exactly,
love.
Which is great. But
yeah. they don't play well together. And if they could, if there was a system for them to play well together, we might see the fashion industry kind of crawl out of the dark ages a mm-hmm. little bit more.
Well, one of the things that I'm trying to do with Course of Trade in the next phase of all of this, and I'm talking to a couple different people about ways to make this happen, is a true teaching factory for New York. Because I do think that one of the things I can't train on as a smaller teaching school is speed. And ultimately, that's what factories really care about. They want to be able to ensure that their workers are highly productive. And if they're very green, they're just simply not as productive as a really seasoned sewer. So, and I think part of that is almost like a temp agency structure. So sewers would be hired and employees of a teaching factory. And then as factories have a need for sewers, the teaching factory can dispatch sewers. And they remain on the teaching factory's health insurance and on their payroll. And then the factories pay the teaching factory to ensure that there's really, you know, great working conditions. And you are really keeping up with these relationships. And then that also means that they're not starting from scratch every time. They can find the sewers. They can make sure that they have someone when they need them. And then it's not as painful when there's a layoff.
This is the model that is playing out in Detroit with the Industrial Sewing and Innovation Center, ISIC for short. Not only have they been investing heavily in rolling out a pre-apprenticeship and apprenticeship curriculum, but they have been working on a social enterprise that looks like a pooled contract manufacturing facility, where they have been able to solidify clients for their end product, and in this case it happens to be workwear, and really make sure that trainees have an opportunity after they've gone through the training to then be in a factory setting, but also with the security that there's still an opportunity to learn. So they're running a business, but it's a business with training at its heart.
Are there any numbers or statistics that put this in context for people? That, I mean, I know, Sarah, you brought a couple of new ones, but...
I mean...
but Libby or Lisa or Lee, what kind of statistics and numbers stick in your head about the problem that we have and what the challenge is?
I think the last figures I saw were, I think it's almost half of the sewing workforce is 50 and up.
Which the silver tsunami, as they call it,
which
I hate that. I hate that phrase. But
it sounds
people, I personally am not a huge fan, but
I think it sounds kind of cool.
But it's talked about in, across subsectors. Again, this is not just a sewn trades thing, but the silver tsunami facing the manufacturing workforce.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be able to throw out a statistic for you safely.
I would say also just my knowledge is anecdotal, really, of just walking into factories and really never seeing a sewer mm-hmm. under 40, 45, I would say.
But I think that's one of the things that the CFDA is focused on doing. So in partnership with ISIC, they're going to be doing a real study of the industry. And I think they'll be able to have a lot of those answers for us.
Well, I think there already are answers, mm-hmm. actually.
Tell us, Sarah.
Well, there's a really interesting pocket of work going on in North Carolina, actually. So there are great partnerships between the community colleges, between teaching factories, between new brands. And they've even stopped calling sewing machine operators that. They call them sewists. And they've really taken a lot of care into what are the drivers of people wanting to work in a garment factory. And they found that they like to take hikes together. Like, that's something that actually really entices them to come to work. I mean, we could argue about the liability in this, but they've also found that giving people the opportunity to use the equipment on off hours on their own projects is something that's really excited a lot of people. So they have new Gen Z workers that are coming in and wanting to be sewists, you know. We're part of the Acumen Fund Future of Work Accelerator, along with UMA, and one of our cohort mates is this amazing nonprofit called Gladio, and they film really exciting content for young people, mechanical engineering jobs, like lower tier jobs where you use your hands, and I think just, again, getting back to this idea of marketing and repositioning those jobs is going to be really crucial.
And I don't think it's my imagination, but I feel as if in the last year there's a lot more conversation around trade schools.
Mm-hmm.
And that the image of a trade school is no longer like, you know?
Yeah. And what we want to do is make it as easy and potentially as fun as playing Candy Crush on your phone to learn how to manipulate a digital pattern. I think micro-credentialing, new technology that allows people to hold on to their credentials through systems like blockchain are going to help people get little skills and not have the big barrier of having to do an 192-hour training or to, you know, get childcare for several weeks while they go to school at night. And I'm really excited to see what innovation is going to come there.
Well, Sarah, you just got back from a lot of traveling. Can you talk about what you saw?
Yes, well, I have some really interesting statistics.
Excellent, excellent.
That I brought back. So I was hanging out with the folks who own sewing equipment companies. So the people that engineer and sell automated equipment going into factories, Juki sewing machines, Gerber laser cutting tables. And we were really thinking about, you know, made in the USA and what are the necessary conditions to bring that reshoring back. So I heard, this was daunting to me, that in terms of our imports of clothing, it's at $88.5 billion. So that is the opportunity in front of us of potential for us to begin to reshore and assume some of that production. Of course, we won't assume all of it, but it's a big pot of opportunity.
Well, that's that term people bring up called right shoring, where it's where it needs to be, where the nimble local production is there when you need it, and then the offshore production is there when you need the massive volume.
Yeah. And there's also talk of, you know, doing some of the manufacturing overseas and then finishing or personalization happening closer to where there's demand. There's the McKinsey report that people talk about all the time, they're predicting that simple garments will be fully automated by 2025. And I just don't see investment happening in these new technologies to get us there. But I think, you know, in about a decade, we'll be there and that will enable more reshoring.
So what were the statistics you found?
Well, I just gave you $88.5
billion. Oh, okay.
See what else I've got here. Rustle the paper for drama.
While Sarah's looking at her notes of statistics, I'll just say from the Urban Manufacturing Alliance standpoint, the goal here is not to be nostalgic, right? So we're not trying to recapture manufacturing that doesn't make sense in urban environments across the U.S., but rather to sort of seize on opportunity that combines high-end craft with technology, design, all of the things that you sort of see a confluence of cities to sort of join all of that together to lift up opportunity for the manufacturing sector and then get the right workforce partners in place to make sure that what's being led by industry is reflected in your workforce systems.
Maybe we should go around and if each of you tell the audience how they can get in touch with your organization and why they might want to, because we have a lot of people who run fashion brands, who run factories, who listen to the show, and a lot of students as well, I think.
I will start. Well, so you should definitely take a look at our website, urbanmfg.org. We're going to have a piece coming out that is being authored by Professor Laura Wolf Powers in partnership with UMA that is really painting a new picture of the sewn trades and also shedding light on much of this sewn trade organizational movement that I talked about today. So keep your eyes open for that. And for any of you big brands out there that are looking to help fuel the movement of local sewing initiatives and all of the great workforce programming that those groups are lifting up, definitely reach out. The Sewn Trades Collective at the Urban Manufacturing Alliance is a new but really energizing group that we have within our network. So that's how you find us. Come to our website.
Amazing. And we are a proud member of the Sewn Trades. So I think it's an amazing group of people, and we've learned so much from your membership.
Thank you. I think the neat thing about it is how many people didn't know that one another existed. Like, every time we'd meet a sewn trades organization, like, what? There's a sewn trades network out there for us to plug into and meet with one another. And so it's always gratifying when you're feeling a space that that is so needed.
So on our side, you can visit us at shimmy.io. It's just like the dance step. And I think for the brands listening, you know, we get interest from brands when a brand is just doing their digital product creation initiative. So maybe they're starting to build 3D models. You know, you have companies like Tommy who are now doing digital product creation as native for their whole line. So we come in and helping a brand's supply chain scale up really quickly, and also from a gender perspective, making sure that the folks in those new technical roles are just as many women as men, because if we didn't intervene, I think those jobs would go to a mostly male workforce. So that's us.
And we can be found at WDINY.org. So our website covers the work we do across the state, but we have a great newsletter that you can sign up for where we have stories about some of the projects that we've supported. So you can get a little bit of an idea of, you know, the various initiatives that we're involved in. And you'll see that we cover a very wide array of workforce topics. We're getting very involved in looking at the new and emerging offshore wind industry. There will be offshore wind farms built in the next 5 years, one off the Rockaways. So we're involved in looking at the skill needs across sectors. But the sewn trades work is mostly New York City. However, I have colleagues up in the Rochester area that are seeing a need for training for skilled sewers as well. So actually have connected Libby and her great curriculum and knowledge to my colleague who covers that region, because there's not for apparel the way that we focus here in the city, but for other pillows and interior items, car seat covers.
Curtains.
Curtains. Probably right about that.
Curtains.
And you can head to courseoftrade.com to find me, or you can email me directly. I'm pretty easy to find. It's just Libby, L-I-B-B-Y, at courseoftrade.com. So if you are looking for a sewer, or you want to be a sewer, or you want to sponsor a sewer to learn how to sew, reach out to me.
Excellent. Well, I believe we have fully developed the workforce at this point. Thank you all for coming. Yeah. This was fascinating.
And great partnering. It's really wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having us.
Thank you.
And then John Philip Sousa music plays, and we're out. Thank you for listening to American Fashion Podcast. On our website, AmericanFashionPodcast.com, you can find our Be a Guest form, as well as a sign-up page for invitations to our live shows, and a new feature, the archives. With roughly 250 episodes published, the old shows don't fit in our feed anymore, so we've made them available for a nominal fee. Please continue the conversation online. On Twitter, we are at AFPOD, and on Instagram, we are at American Fashion Show. And I personally am at Fashion Tech Guru on just about everything. For direct comments, give us a call at 646-979-8709. That's our voicemail line. Or email info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com. American Fashion Podcast is produced by Mouth Media Network, which holds the copyright to this and all other episodes, all rights reserved. Subsist, friends. Keep making things beautiful. Remain in force. I'm Charles Beckwith, and we'll talk to you again next week.
This is Mouth Media Network, audio for business.